a recording from the November 17th book launch of The Remedy at the Wise Hall. The Remedy is a book of queer and trans voices on health and healthcare. To quote from the book's press kit, "The Remedy means to heal, to cure, to set right, to make reparations." This recording, split in two halves, contains live readings from six of The Remedy's contributors, including an introduction from The Remedy's editor, Zina Sharman. If you'd like to listen to or download this podcast, you can find it online under our special broadcast page at citr.ca/radio/special-broadcast. To purchase The Remedy, you can go to arsenalpulp.com.
It's very weird and exciting that this is real and happening because this book has been in the works for over 2 years. So I know. It's like, it's the thing. It's why I'm drinking my water bottle with my rescue remedy in it right now. The other remedy. Thank you, naturopath. So I really want to thank all of you for being here. This book is... It is such a gift from the community of people who came together to create it. There are 30 writers who are part of The Remedy. A number of them are here tonight, and you'll get to hear their amazing words. And it also is a gift to the community from all of us. I also, of course, want to say that we are on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people, and that is a huge acknowledgement. I think about that all the time as I live and write on these lands, and I wanted to let you folks know that I'll be donating half of my royalties as the editor to Indigenous-led organizations. So the money I make from The Remedy, half of it will go to Indigenous organizations. It's like rent, basically, and reparations. So that is important. And when I was thinking about what I wanted to say to you tonight, and I will read to you from my introduction to the book as well, but to introduce the introduction, The Remedy reminds us that health is both individual and collective. We have 30 authors, as I said, from across the continent who are coming together to tell their stories. A community of sorts, and I absolutely have built new friendships with these contributors over the last couple of years. And I want to invite you to lean into that spirit. So if it feels comfortable to you, we're going to do a small repeat after me exercise, which may feel awkward for the introverts, so feel free to tap out of this experience. But I would love for you to turn to your neighbor. Let's say turn to the left, because God knows we need a left turn right now. And as you look to your neighbor, and I didn't really think this through, so just we're going to do it one person and then another person. But this is magic, and this is a spell, and I mean that. I want you to turn to your neighbor, and I want you to say these words. Your health and my health are interdependent. I want you to say, your health matters to me. And I want you to say to your neighbor, I am so glad you're here. And as we have this moment of connecting in community and affirming the presence of each of you here, I also want us to take a moment to remember all of the lives that have been lost. Our queer and trans family, because of inadequate, inaccessible, or violent healthcare encounters. They are our ancestors, and they are with us. And we will and we must fight for them and for their and our descendants. Okay? Great. Thanks, Sanford Dawn. And I also want us to take a moment to acknowledge our own hurt places and the times we've done harm in the context of health. And also, really, so importantly, to breathe in, and I want you to do this because I am really woo, to breathe in compassion and our incredible resilience. So let's breathe that in. Feel that. That is real. One of the through lines that came through in a number of the pieces in the anthology is this refrain, I am here, I exist, sometimes in spite of a lot of fucking bullshit. And I want us to draw up strength and optimism and hope, especially right now when many of us might need it even more than usual. The remedy is a spell, and I want your help to spread this magic. And the other piece, of course, is just to take care of yourselves however you need to. Some of these stories might resonate with you in difficult or painful ways, and I recognize that. So take care of yourself and of each other. Thank you. Okay, let's do this. Why queer and trans health stories matter. A common thread connects the narratives in the remedy. The power of stories and how health information circulates in queer and trans communities. Who the good queer and trans competent family doctors are, and who's accepting patients. How to navigate the process of getting public funding for gender-affirming surgery, and how to heal from that surgery. All of the things not captured in the surgeon's standard post-operative instruction sheet. The kind of knowledge you only accumulate by living it. How to find a queer and trans-savvy, trauma-informed therapist who won't pathologize your sexual or relational choices and who isn't dating your closest friend or your ex or both and who ideally has a sliding scale. That's a unicorn right there. Who makes the best unscented styling products so you can be an ally to your friends with chemical sensitivities and have awesome hair? Side note, coconut oil. Which STI clinic has the cool tattooed nurses, and I know some of you are in the room, who don't bat an eye at what you did last weekend and who bring respect, knowledge, and empathy into every encounter? And horror stories, too. Healthcare providers and clinics to avoid. Asking for support and validation from friends after being repeatedly referred to by the wrong name or the wrong gender pronoun during a healthcare visit. Dealing with the physical, emotional, and economic implications of being unable to find or access or afford the essential health services you so desperately need. Crowdfunding campaigns urgently seeking to fill the places where the system or the social safety net falls short. Memorial after memorial after memorial for friends and loved ones lost to violence or suicide. Our community is no stranger to loss, to individual and collective trauma, to lives lived in the gaps and the in-between places. We make do and we remake. We crowdsource our health in a community with a long history of caring for one another outside of, and often in spite of, dominant systems and structures. We document and gather and share information, filling the gaps in the evidence where our lives, needs, and identities are increasingly but still insufficiently visible. We tell stories and we take care of each other. There's a rich and growing literature on queer and trans health, but it seems to me that people's stories are missing from a conversation that's often centered on things like research data and guidelines for healthcare providers. The remedy puts queer and trans voices at the center of the conversation. I can trace the origins of this anthology back to Sexual Medicine Day, when I spent an afternoon in a classroom full of first-year medical students. Several hundred of them listened intently as my colleagues and I delivered an introductory lecture on queer and trans health. We talked about terminology, disparities, stigma, and resilience, gave tips on inclusive and affirming care. After class, I joined in on a tutorial where I answered students' questions about my queer life and my identity. Their desire to become competent, respectful clinicians was palpable, as was their appetite for information. I felt acutely aware of the power of connection in that moment, of what can happen when we just sit down together and talk. It's no wonder those first-year medical students were hungry for knowledge. They're learning in an environment where relatively little time is dedicated to formal training on queer and trans health. A recent survey of 150 U.S. and Canadian medical schools reported an average of 5 hours dedicated to teaching the content in the entire curriculum. Consider this in the context of U.S. data from a survey of 4,400 straight first-year medical students. The study found that 46% of them expressed at least some degree of conscious bias against gay and lesbian people. That's what they studied in this particular survey. The study also found that about 82% of them had unconscious bias against gay and lesbian people. Interestingly, they also found that more frequent and more positive intergroup contact, which is research fancy way of saying getting together, between these students and sexual minorities predicted more positive attitudes toward them. Now, I don't mean to single out medical students or doctors. The entire healthcare system is implicated in creating a persistent negative culture towards sexual and gender minority populations that manifests as stigma and discrimination and exerts a powerful influence on health disparities. A 2010 Lambda legal survey on healthcare discrimination found that 56% of lesbian, gay, or bisexual respondents, 70% of trans and gender non-conforming respondents, and almost 63% of people living with HIV had experienced at least one of the following types of discrimination. Some of these may sound familiar to you. Being refused needed care. Healthcare providers refusing to touch them or using excessive precautions. Providers using harsh or abusive language, being blamed for their health status, providers being physically rough or abusive. In almost every category of this survey, trans and gender non-conforming people reported the highest rates of discrimination and barriers to care. And a higher proportion of respondents who were people of color or low income reported experiencing discriminatory and substandard care. Most of the people who participated in this survey expected to experience discrimination from their healthcare providers. Let me say that again. Most of the people who participated in this survey expected to experience discrimination from their healthcare providers. And for those of you who are shocked or angered by this revelation, I want you to sit with this feeling for a moment. Feel it in your body. Hold it in your heart. Use it as part of the foundation for your allyship, for the active and embodied work of solidarity. Now keep reading, or as the case may be, listening. And then there are those of you who are thinking, tell me something I didn't already know, because you have become so accustomed to weighing the likelihood of discrimination or mistreatment by your healthcare providers against the severity of your health concerns. That's assuming you have access to healthcare in the first place, something many folks struggle with for a whole host of reasons. To you, I offer this apology. I am so sorry the system is failing you, that your healthcare providers are failing you, that we are failing you. You deserve so much better. It doesn't take a PhD or a medical degree to figure out that experiencing systemic discrimination is lousy for your health. It's as intuitive as it is complex. Whole books have been written about queer and trans health disparities and how to resolve them through research and care. I feel grateful to their authors, grateful that these books exist. Grateful for the weight of their authority in a world that often feels like it's trying to disappear us, tell us that our concerns don't matter, that we shouldn't be so sensitive, that it's our fault, that we should do as we're told, take what we're offered, say thank you, shut up. Privilege and oppression, sorry, I'm just feeling my feels and I missed a paragraph. Say thank you, shut up. Now keep talking, Zena. I feel the weight of this awareness as I face the overwhelming prospect of trying to summarize the complexities of queer and trans health in a paragraph or two. There's no monolithic experience, no simple narrative, no easy way to lump and slice the incredible diversity that characterizes queer and trans identities, communities, and lives. And these identities don't exist in isolation. Privilege and oppression intersect with and derive from homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, racism, colonialism, ableism, fatphobia, sexism, classism, ageism, and so on. They are as present in and shaping of whole systems of care as they are in individual lives. You need to understand this context in order to understand why trans folks tend to fare worse than cisgender folks and why trans women experience the health impacts of trans misogyny. Why queer and trans people of color and indigenous people experience poorer health outcomes than their white peers. Why poor and working class queers have greater health disparities than wealthy ones. Why borders, geography, and where you live have an enormous influence on your access to healthcare. Why all of this is a result of health being rooted in complex structures of privilege and oppression, not because being queer or trans is inherently bad for your health. The Remedy isn't a book about statistics. And it's not about comfort. Some of the stories in this anthology might make you uncomfortable. They might hit too close to home. They might trigger a memory of an awful healthcare encounter or a time you really screwed up with a client or a patient or a friend. They might make you realize that you're screwing up right now. Many of these stories bear witness to the lived experience of systemic and individual failures of care. But The Remedy is also about hope and resilience, an affirmation that we are here, that we are amazingly strong, that we deserve more, that people and providers and systems can do so much better, and that in many contexts, they already are. More than 30 people from across North America share their experiences in this collection, each essay or poem or drawing, a testament to the life-saving necessity of queer and trans stories. There's a great deal of honesty, courage, and vulnerability in the pages of The Remedy. People bravely sharing the truth of their lives as patients and healthcare providers, healers and students, activists and artists. This book grew out of my desire to see these stories, these voices, reflected on the page. I hope you recognize parts of yourself in this book, that it makes you ask questions, teaches you something. I hope it makes you happy and sad and angry, and that you notice all the things that are missing from it. The Remedy isn't the whole story of queer and trans health. It's part of an ongoing conversation. I hope you add your voice and your story to it, too. May we all listen and bear witness to one another. And may we all join together in the fight for queer and trans health. Thank you. And we've just got a group of folks who just arrived, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about our amazing next reader. Well, these people make themselves comfortable. I am going to tell you about the incredible first contributor that I am inviting up to the stage. So proud and honored to have his story in this book. Ahmed Dani Ramadan is an experienced journalist who's had bylines appearing in The Washington Post, The Guardian, and Foreign Policy. Now he is the volunteer coordinator at Community, BC's Queer Resource Center. An author with two collections of short stories published in Arabic, he is planning to, and in fact it is coming out so soon, his first novel in English. And he's got a novel called The Clothesline Swing coming out in April 2017. So mark your calendars for that. It's going to be another wonderful book and another wonderful book launch. A jack of all trades who found his calling in activism, civil society, journalism, and creative writing, as well as his personal experience as a former gay refugee, Dani is passionate about the values of volunteerism and democracy and the causes of social justice and LGBTQ refugees' rights. Please join me in welcoming Dani to the stage.
Well, before I start, I just want to point out that telling this story is a bit triggering for myself. So if I'm really sorry if it caused you any triggering. And if it caused me to, like, be triggered on the stage, that would be seriously not fun for me. But I'll share that experience with you, and I hope that we can share that uncomfortable moment together. I'm going to read a story called A Journey Towards Safety. She tells me that controlling my social anxiety is as easy as controlling the way I breathe. I need to inhale for 4 counts, hold it in for 2, then release the air in 6 calming, relaxing counts, and repeat until I feel calmer. 4, 2, 6, like a football game strategy, easy to remember, simple to practice. But I don't believe her. My counselor, a white woman in her late 40s, tried to talk to me into calming down, tried to guide me through meditation techniques and to talk to me about stress levels. She spoke an alien language to me. I detested my visits to her. They felt like a burden. Her words, as she guided me through my issues, felt enforced and belittling. Her voice felt like scratches on the side of my brain. I didn't realize it back then, but when I arrived to Canada, I was very tired. I was tired after being a gay Syrian refugee in Lebanon for 2 years, working hard on meeting the very basic of life needs: water to drink, food to eat, and shelter to provide warmth, and dignified work. There was only one thing that I didn't require: physical safety. Now, you see, my physical safety was violated so many times that it didn't matter much to me anymore. I never lived in a country where I felt completely and utterly safe. I never slept in a bed where I didn't jump out of it at the calmest of whispers. I never walked in a dark street where I didn't stare at people's eyes, fearing that they might be able to see through mine, to tell that I'm queer. Building walls around me back in the Middle East was the only way, was the only coping mechanism possible for me. I couldn't control the world around me. I couldn't change the whole society. I didn't have a single place that I considered safe. But for the first couple of months after I arrived here in Vancouver, I somehow forgot about those walls. Or maybe they forgot about me. I unpacked my bags and excitedly explored the city. Life was bright, happy, calm, and tickling to the point of giggles. I slept with both my eyes closed and drifted into a land of dreams uninterrupted. But it turned out that I didn't leave those walls behind. They came here with me. And Vancouver's lingering winter brought with it a lack of sun, the desperate search for a job, and a newcomer's loneliness. My walls were on alert. They knew that they should protect me. They just didn't know how. My counselor, well, she didn't pick up on any of that. Bless her, she tried. She tried to calm me down. She tried to help me overcome those anxious moments and to feel peace. But she didn't understand that those fears were rooted within me, that those walls weren't built upon arriving here in Canada. They were with me all along, hidden inside of my soul, and simply modified in the face of those new challenges. When confronted with danger so foreign to me, the only way I could protect myself was to isolate within my own walls. The more I talked to my counselor, the more locked in I felt. So I abandoned counseling and decided to rely on myself in seeking the mental and physical healing I needed. Months later, I was still struggling with my mental health. My self-esteem suffered. I struggled with physical pains that I couldn't explain, and I lost a lot of weight. My family doctor, himself an immigrant, while white, from South Africa, dismissed it all. "You're fine," he told me, pointedly looking at his watch. "It's all normal. Just be normal." As I walked out of the clinic, I felt dismissed and cared for and lonely. Later that fall, I found myself at a table full of friends and strangers sharing a Canadian Thanksgiving dinner that I have been talked into attending. I ended up sitting beside this white queer man who worked as a naturopathic doctor. Over the course of the meal, I told him my story. At the end of the night, he handed me his card and said he might be able to help. Well, I've never been to a naturopath before. The concept seemed funny, like a pseudoscience, but I pushed myself and I decided to try. My first impression was how warm and accessible he was. We talked about comics and superheroes, a queer party we both wanted to go to on the weekend, and our favorite smells. He made me feel comfortable and didn't shy away from exposing his own feelings. He asked me personal questions in a respectful way, understanding my reluctance to answer some of them, and providing alternative ways to express myself. "How's your libido?" he asked, smiling. "I've never talked to a doctor about my sexual habits before," I told him, trying to avoid the topic. "It's all right. That's completely understandable. I would find it weird to speak about my sexual habits to a total stranger," he said. "We can use metaphors if you prefer, or maybe work with words in your own language that you're comfortable using. I'm willing to learn if you're willing to teach me." We laughed, And I told him about my libido. Unlike some people I've never met who suffered from what I thought of as the white man savior complex, thinking that they knew better than me how to handle my own life and challenged every decision I made, my naturopathic doctor respected my agency. And I've never been to a massage therapist before. I had to convince myself to go. It's for rich, white, powerful men. And I'm not even sure how I feel about strangers touching my body. But I soon found one who made me feel at ease. He was a person of color himself from Hawaii, funny and encouraging. Like me, he knew how uncomfortable it feels to be treated as exotic and reduced to a stereotype. He respected me and supported me from that perspective. He told me about his own life and his own culture and was interested in knowing more about my own. We never talked about the war in Syria, but we talked about Syria a lot. He's the only person who didn't persist in asking me to detail of my experience as a refugee. Instead, he treated me like any other person, and that was exactly what I needed. Between my naturopath and my massage therapist, I began to feel the positive benefits that those two health professionals had on my entire life. My comfort level started to grow within me, big enough for me to go back to counseling. In the first session with my new counselor, an indigenous woman who specialized in trauma and grief, I told her about my past experiences with counseling. She listened to me intently, then asked me to listen to her. "You're a smart person," she said, "and you're good at self-reflecting. You need a counselor who realizes that and who's able to actually outsmart you." It was true. I was very protective of myself, and she saw the walls that I've built around me for years, and she was willing to climb them and to challenge me in the process. I used to feel like the world was falling down on me, like a child trapped under the rubble of my own reality and surviving on the tiny bits of air I could get a grasp. Now I hear my dreamed rescue team of health providers telling me to hold on, and I know I'm on my way to finally feel safe. Thank you very much.
So amazing. And again, we've got more folks filtering in, so please make yourselves at home. Really so excited to welcome up our next reader, Chase Willier. Chase is a Nehiya from Saddle Lake Cree Nation and Sucker Creek First Nation in Alberta. He was part of the 60s Scoop and grew up in the Silks Nation, where he was traditionally adopted. Chase spent 30 years in the RCMP working with First Nations as a Two-Spirit woman before he retired and transitioned. He is presently writing his memoir and is happily married with a new baby girl. Please give a big, loving Remedy welcome to Chase.
A decade later, while working with a lesbian clinical counselor, that I discovered a practitioner who actually used the C word. Finally, I was being acknowledged as someone who came from a history of trauma and loss resulting from colonization. I also began to see how oppression wasn't just a First Nations experience for me. There were other intersections at play, and I could now acknowledge other aspects of self, which, surprisingly, brought up the same feelings. Finding the vibrant gay community in Vancouver really helped me shed the layer of shame that had kept me isolated for so long. It honestly surprised me, the sense of freedom and happiness, just being at ease with self and finding community. My elders were accepting of my Two-Spirit identity, and Glenn told me a story of an Okanagan woman who was also Two-Spirit and was a highly revered war chief. I couldn't help but feel even more connected to culture. His elder, Naspil in Washington, still remembered a time before contact when not only being a woman, but gender identity and expression were healthy and thriving. Today, our communities are still recovering from the isms and obeas introduced with colonization, and far too often, two-spirit trans people are the target of hatred. Sadly, it comes from both worlds, not just on reserve in small communities, but also when two-spirit trans folk escape to the city to find community only to once again encounter racism, trans, homophobia, and other challenges. I can't help but think of spawning salmon swimming upstream, fighting to reach a goal that may be unattainable. Transitioning reminds me of my struggles growing up. The feeling of vulnerability and the potential for violence are similar, only this time it's my gender, or lack thereof, not race. That is the issue for many around me. And although I have learned to temper my hypervigilance, which is a part of my PTSD, I remain acutely aware of my surroundings. The classic hallmark stares I get due to my lack of conforming to the gender binary will be with me until my body fully transitions. However, it is more subtle assaults that are difficult to see coming and that are often leaving me in doubt. The change in attitude of the once friendly conversational ultrasound therapist who suddenly shifts cold and mute is suspect. Others' more hurtful actions conducted in public carry the same harsh blows as racism inflicts. I refer to this as a deer in the headlights phenomenon. Somehow, I'm always stunned and unprepared, rarely able to respond because I feel like I've been kicked in the chest. The internalized anger at myself for not immediately challenging the incident is exacerbated since I temporarily am winded and without words. The pain is deep and debilitating. There resides a level of frustration and rawness that exists below the surface that only my brothers and sisters know. It keeps the other isolated, questioning their sanity and their self-worth. It would explain the statistics around suicide for First Nations people, for trans folk, and so many others who are marginalized. And after a lifetime of constant re-injury or aggravation, a person's ability to withstand these assaults is whittled away. Sometimes, that's when they enter the healthcare system. They may be desperately in need of help, but are unwilling or resistant, especially if experience has shown them that they will be judged or worse. Only they enter the system as a last resort, the cost of not trying one last fatal time. Some 30 years later, as a retired RCMP officer, full of confidence and life experience, I'm reminded how deep those wounds are the moment I ask for help. The role of shame is a powerful and pervasive presence, even today. Advocating for self, having a voice, and being able to use it has not been an easy lesson. Asserting self and confronting an issue around healthcare is probably one of the most accurate measures of my self-worth. One of the most difficult experiences in healthcare occurred at the UBC Operational Stress Injury Clinic when I was first assessed and sought treatment for my PTSD. I was already experiencing considerable anxiety, which I tried to control with my avoidance behaviors, which I'm pretty good at. So when I sensed judgment from the practitioner early on, I began to stress over our sessions rather than the actual trauma work itself, and things began to unravel quickly. Somehow I felt in the wrong and full of self-doubt. Was it my trans identity? Was it race? I tried not to project. Whatever it was, something was undermining our sessions. I needed to advocate for herself, address the problem, and request another counselor. My resistance to rocking the boat and my fear around exacerbating the situation were grounded in previous experiences. Prior conflicts usually prove that I wasn't the one in power and that I would get hurt. The idea of putting myself out there at further risk goes against anyone's nature. Fortunately, the issue was managed effectively, and with a short period of time, I was assigned a new practitioner, Dr. Molly Bates. Yay, Molly. Surprisingly, things moved along quickly and trust was established early on, since the presence of respect, empathy, and non-judgment in the room was palpable. I suspected that this practitioner understood that people coming from a long history with oppression have their own mechanisms and tools that they use to survive, and I am no different. Not only is my history with colonization complex, but also accumulative in nature, specifically around trauma. Grief and loss are not the same as someone coming from a nuclear family where they may not have lost a family member until they were an adult, nor suffered disconnection from community, language, or culture as a result of government policies. My faith and trust in a counselor who is capable of discussing privilege as it relates to oppression is well placed. I know I'm in good hands, and I also know that the person who sits across from me not only has done her own work, but has taken responsibility for it. I've never had to educate my practitioner on competencies around my identities, nor is it my responsibility anymore. I have expectations around respect, cultural competencies, and a shared learning environment. Active listening skills are a part of that, since it's how I know if someone is genuine or not. In general, law enforcement personnel interrupt someone speaking every 7 to 9 seconds. Quick assessment is required under certain conditions, particularly for emergency responders, so this practice is understandable within the workplace. However, certain practices that work under specific conditions do not carry over to the other. And more often than not, two cultures, whether they be First Nations, queer, trans, and yes, even policing and healthcare, usually come into conflict. There must be a mindfulness around listening and respect, which is just the beginning of the relationship. Creating safe space requires hard work. And if there's anything I know for a fact, it's that safety is absolutely essential to my wellness. As my identities are acknowledged and given a voice, only then can I move into a space beyond survival mode. In a way, it reminds me of ceremony, where under certain conditions have to be carefully prepared in order for spirit to come. It's respectful tones, the welcoming, the coming together in a way that honors the other.
I would like to now introduce our last reader for this half of the show, because there's more. She's definitely the person, I haven't seen all of your shoes, but I'm pretty sure Amber Dawn is wearing the best shoes in the entire room. I mean, if we wanted to have a shoe off later, I'm obviously 100% in favor of that plan. Or a boot off, I'm flexible. It's another conversation. Jane and Paul, I'm sorry if that was awkward. My date's parents. Anyways, let's continue. Amber Dawn is laughing into the remedy. See, it's a joyful experience as much as we are dealing with complex structures of privilege and oppression. Hey-oh. I remain optimistic. I really do. It's why I'm here. It's why I do this work. So Amber Dawn, in addition to having really awesome footwear with which to kick the patriarchy in some body part, is also a writer, a filmmaker, and a performance artist. She is the author of the Lambda Literary Award-winning novel Sub Rosa, the memoir How Poetry Saved My Life, which won the Vancouver Book Award, and also the poetry book Where the Words End and My Body Begins. Read them all. She is also the editor of Fist of the Spider Woman, Tales of Fear and Queer Desire, and co-editor of With a Rough Tongue, Femmes Write Porn. She has an MFA in creative writing. Her award-winning docu-porn, Girl on Girl, has been screened in 8 countries. It's in your bio! Amber Dawn was the 2012 winner of the Writers' Trust of Canada, Dana Ogilvie Pride for LGBT writers. I just wanted to say all of your accolades. It's not even a complete list. Amber Dawn, get on up here.
I just, if I started to say all the thank yous, I would use up the 10 minutes that I need to spend with you on thank yous. So I will keep it to one, and that's, I want to thank the contributors that are reading here tonight. I know, like myself, many of you wrote this piece for The Remedy under great personal risk, emotional risk, and I thank you. And I know many of you did not look at it again until you're up here on the stage reading it aloud, which is a feeling. So thank you for doing that work. Sex work, solidarity as healing in four parts. One, trust exercise. Once upon a time, in fact, I'm referring to 1996, but maybe the familiarity of a fairy tale intro will thwart the standard Dubaiity or othering that occurs when a sex worker speaks up. Othering is the means in which sex workers are rendered into makeshift statistics within countless shelved reports. Othering is how sex workers' voices are dismissed as the most current legislation governing prostitution is being passed, C-36, for example. Moreover, othering is an everyday mindset that pervasively allows negative perceptions of sex workers to be openly asserted, as in we are heteronormative family wreckers, criminals, disease spreaders, drains on the systems, victims, patriarchy perpetrators, and even some cisgender and trans queer circles see us as inconvenient obstacles to mainstream acceptance. Before I read this essay about accessing appropriate health and wellness as a sex care worker, I'm going to ask you to reflect on your own relationship to othering, perpetuating, witnessing, and surviving it, and how it has impacted your health. You're here at the Remedy launch, and if I take this as a clue, I can imagine aspects of your own identity have been ousted by the dominant mainstream, and maybe othering has literally sickened you too. Solidarity work is much more complicated than we're all in this together kind of thinking, of course. I'd like to share some personal and practical knowledge I've learned about how to solidarize with sex workers. And sex workers need close allies. Not for the sake of the argument close, not save the less fortunate close, but eye to eye close. To encourage this closeness, I will invite you to participate in self-reflection, seek and find games, holistic intervention, and yes, I'll use fairy tale phrasing. Once upon a time, in 1996, a family physician was seeing a patient for the first time. This patient disclosed that she was violently raped by a bad date while working the street, and since then she's had difficulty managing back and leg pain, sleeping, eating, concentrating. This patient said, "I've only had shitty experiences with doctors. What can you tell me that will help me trust you?" Now imagine you are that family physician or nurse, that social worker, that clinical supervisor, healthcare researcher, emergency room receptionist, frontline shelter worker, LGBTQ2S hotline volunteer, that confidant or lover or friend. What would you say to help build trust? Did you actually imagine it? What would you say to help build trust? I was wondering if you could do me a favor. It's available to you. Did any of you think that the first thing you would say is, "I believe you"? Raise your hand if you did. Yeah, thank you. That's what this doctor said to me. I'm going to move us out of the doctor's office. To be honest, I didn't want to contribute to the Remedy. But because I love Zena Sharman, I was very close to her journey editing this book. And I said, "Well, are there any contributors that are talking about sex work?" And there wasn't. It's no shortage of talent and it's no shortage of voices. It's that decriminalization still isn't a reality for us. Our identities are criminalized. Everyone I know, everyone who's close to me, can't come out. I can't even dedicate my piece right now to other sex workers in the audience for their fear and safety of being out. So I will continue to do this work, and I really hope that you can join me in doing it. Decriminalization is a big part of my essay, and I talk about why we should all become very articulate in talking about decriminalization, how it will greatly help us be able to mobilize as healthcare providers and as sex workers in connecting. There's also lots of statistical data. There's some research. There's a resource list. But mostly what I like to do is tell personal stories. So I'm going to actually skip through all of that with the faith that you will kindly read it if you have the capacity to. And I'm going to just skip to the last part of my four-part essay. So here we go. Part four, holistic intervention. In a land far, far away. In fact, I'm referring to a recent queer dance party held in a warehouse located along one of Vancouver's last street working strolls. Like any queer dance party, a good number of partygoers, myself included, were hanging around outside to air our sweaty bodies or smoke or flirt with sweaty smokers. A gorgeous queen in Daisy Duke sauntered over to the curb and pretended to hustle. Her friends hooted at her. My chest tightened. This party was located 6.5 blocks away from where I was violently date raped by a bad date. Some femme shouted, "No, honey, you are way prettier than the hookers around here." My temples began to ring. 3 blocks away is where Sheila Catherine Egan was last seen. 1 block away is where Jenny Firminger was last seen. I remember the names because I remember them. Sheila was 2 years younger than me. Jenny was born and raised in my hometown. Is this how they shall be spoken of? As quote-unquote ugly hookers by queer kids stopping by the stroll for a cheap place to drink and dance. Don't you ever insult the women in this neighborhood, I say, my voice raised. Everyone around me froze. The femme eyed her friends pleadingly, like she was looking for backup. It was just a joke, she said. I lay into her again. Don't you ever. No blood tests can detect grief or disgrace. No research survey can quantify the harmful impact of having your queer communities, your so-called safe, inclusive spaces, other you again and again. To be othered by anti-sex worker comments or jokes stings, certainly. What cuts deeper is the other of having no one stand beside you. No one offered me a single word of solidarity in that moment, and that moment is by no means a unique example. At times, this has caused me to see other queers as potential threats to my dignity and well-being. And it has also caused me to isolate from queer communities altogether. There are always ways to intervene against othering. And when I say intervention, I'm not talking about one of those pop sensational reality shows about addiction. I'm talking about holistic and preventative care. The healing properties of allyship also cannot be measured by medical assessment, but they are equally real. And we must believe we can heal from the sickness and from the damage. Staging an intervention against othering requires some planning. The greatest care an ally might offer is simply being ready to speak up, stand up with sex workers. I'm going to offer you the following examples. A friend calls me the day before the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers, which, by the way, is on December 17th, and y'all should go, and asks if I'd like her to march in the red umbrella procession with me, and should she call other friends so I have an entire posse to march with. A professor at the creative writing department, where I now work, performs a pro-decriminalization-themed TEDx talk called The Red Umbrella, Sex Work, Stigma, and the Law, and forwards the YouTube link to all of our colleagues. I sit in my cubicle with awe as I read the thoughtful and affirming replies coming from nearly every professor and staff member. Being out at work has become more secure in a matter of hours. A friend joins me each year to host a fundraiser cabaret for the Missing and Women's Memorial March. Together we gather a group of queer artists who volunteer their time and talent to raise money for the Indigenous and other community elders and families of the missing and murdered women. Sometimes I keep the donation money in my bra before I hand it over to the elders just for old time's sake. My wife takes the morning off work to go to a sensitive doctor's visit with me. She says, I can wait in the lobby or I can come in the exam room. And she says, I can help you vocalize your concerns or I can just sit and support you quietly. And afterwards, she says, I can take you to that fried chicken place that you like. She says, I love you. She says, I'm with you. And that family physician from once upon a time in 1996 happens to be a lesbian doctor. After years in family medicine, she moved to a different field of care, but I see her from time to time at queer events. She greets me with professional discretion, but also undeniable warmth. I will never forget her saying, I believe you. And right now, you are all here listening to my words. I thank you for your kind attention and for your solidarity. Never forget that you too can be part of this integral healing work. Thank you.
Amber Dawn, so talented. Basically, I just love all of you, and I'm really glad you're here, which is literally not an exaggeration. So what I will say before we go into the intermission is I just specifically do want to acknowledge one organization that I have a deep and abiding love for, so much so that I literally cry during every single board meeting. I emotively joy cry. It's the Catherine White Holman Wellness Center. And so some of you may be familiar with the center. It's a holistic healthcare center for trans and gender variant folks, totally volunteer run, and it's a really beautiful, incredible space. We've got some information about the CWHWC, we all got to have an acronym, at the back of the room. So feel free to get it and look it up on the internet and like it on Facebook and all those things. Speaking of liking things on Facebook, I would also like to tell you that The Remedy is on the internet. I've had people giving me coaching, like they made me join Instagram kind of coaching. So there is a website for The Remedy. I would love you to share it with your friends. It is writetheremedy.com. And if you want to get all hashtaggy about things, why not just hashtag it The Remedy? That would be exciting for me. It's what I want. And obviously, I want you to buy the book if it is within your means. We have Ken from Little Sisters here selling the book. I also can tell you that it is on order at the Vancouver Public Library. I checked today, so put in your little hold request. And I would love for you to request it. Make sure the other libraries in your life have copies of this book. If you are a teacher or you are a student learning about healthcare or gender in some capacity, tell your professors to teach this book. I want this spell to spread.